The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Armchair Traveler. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from National Geographic. Before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, please let me remind you that neither the North Carolina Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles that we'll be reading. These are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. Our journey on today's Armchair Traveler begins with an article titled The Rediscovered Secrets of Project Iceworm. Now, if you like mysteries and history about military affairs, you're going to enjoy this. The article is written by Neil Shea and illustrated by Matt Griffin. It appeared in the February 2025 issue of National Geographic. As the editors tell us, at the height of the Cold War, a classified military program built an improbable nuclear base under the Arctic ice. Now scientists are taking a fresh look at what went on there and drawing critical new insights about climate change. Join us now as we journey to the coldest Cold War post, Camp Century, which was carved into Greenland's ice sheet more than 100 miles from Thule Air Base. The Camp Century was heralded as a scientific research station, but masked a secret scheme. Its creators wanted to stash some 600 nuclear missiles in the ice and snow-covered trenches aimed at the Soviet Empire's most strategic cities. Now let's hear the story. On a freezing day in October 1960, a team of U.S. Army technicians toiling at the top of the world stood in the belly of a glacier, making the final preparations that would bring a nuclear reactor to life. It was an experimental model, smallish and fickle, and those, of course, were the early years of atomic energy. The men knew that a single burst of radiation could kill them. They were surrounded by walls of glistening snow that muffled their voices, reflected the beams cast by their lights, and absorbed the tick-tick-ticking of their Geiger counters. Far above their heads arched a ceiling of corrugated steel. Beneath their feet lay a mile-thick slab of ice, so old it reached back to the Pleistocene. Now, when the chain reaction finally began, there was a flash of relief, maybe a tight shout of triumph, in the nearby control room. But within minutes, the team was scrambling to shut the reactor down. Somewhere deep in the ice was a leak. Radioactive neutrons were spilling into the darkness. Imagine the men there for a moment, encased in a glacier in Greenland, struggling to fire up a reactor, perhaps the only humans to be so perfectly suspended between the ice age and the atomic age. No one had ever done what they were doing, and no one would ever try it again. Publicly, the elaborate gambit they were a part of was meant to project American ingenuity. The careful construction of a vast under ice military base named Camp Century that would show the world that the United States could transform even the coldest, harshest environment into a habitable place. It would be the first ice fort to end all ice forts. The world's first atomic-powered military station carved into a glacier was a triumph of engineering, a victory over the elements, its brave crews bringing civilization and scientific rigor to the polar waste. After Camp Century was up and running, newspapers and magazines, including National Geographic, sent reporters to visit the Arctic outpost and tour its labyrinth of tunnels, all lit up by that reactor. By then, its leak fixed with lead bricks and a lot of inventive engineering. What the visiting journalists weren't told, nor were many of the soldiers living at the station, which could house up to 200, was that Camp Century was a cover for a secret Cold War Army project. Unknown even to Greenland's Danish government, the plan remained classified for decades. America's ambition in the frozen north wasn't so much about developing portable atomic power. It was about turning Ice Cap into a sprawling ballistic missile base. The Army, according to now declassified documents, cited the area's unique adaptability to nuclear deployment, remote, near Russia, and hard to target. The plan, known as Project Iceworm, imagined threading the tunnels of Camp Century and beyond with railway tracks that could covertly house and transport up to 600 nuclear-tipped missiles that could be aimed over the pole at the Soviet Union. Today, nothing of that audacious military scheme remains. Camp Century was abandoned long ago by the Army, and its tunnels beneath the snow crushed and swallowed by the restless ice. But a more surprising legacy endures, thanks to several long-overlooked jars stashed away in a deep-freeze storage for decades. Some of the last remnants of an unheralded scientific project performed at Camp Century, the unexpected evidence inside those jars, is now offering modern scientists a startling glimpse into the wetter, wilder, and more chaotic age that may await us. For the 7 years that the base was operational, personnel at Camp Century labored and lived in extreme isolation. The base lay 127 miles from the nearest human outpost, an Air Force base called Thule. Shipments of food, fuel, and equipment were dragged on sleds to Century in long convoys known as swings. This was how people reached the camp, too. Austin Kovacs, an Army research engineer now in his 80s who spent several seasons living at the camp, remembers that traveling by swing took many hours, even in the best conditions. And in bad weather, blizzards, whiteouts, the severe cold that could fall like a hammer, the journey might take days. Sometimes swings even got lost in the endless Arctic void. Still, the real risk, Kovacs says, was boredom at the camp. People thought it was dangerous, and it was not dangerous. It was comfortable, and at times it was very, very monotonous. The men lived in prefabricated bunkhouses constructed inside the ice. Kovacs worked in what he called Trench 33, where he researched and studied foundations to support large buildings on polar ice caps. There was no sunlight, no birdsong, no breeze. Movies were shown at the base theater at least once a week. The library offered a modest collection of books. The men showered and shaved in a communal bathroom, ate in a bright mess hall. All kinds of waste, trash, sewage, industrial chemicals, even the radioactive water used to cool the reactor, was dumped back into the glacier where it remains frozen in place for now. They drank water drawn from a well in the glacier, and once, when Kovacs and his comrades needed excitement, they lowered themselves down the well's steel cable, dropping down a claustrophobically narrow ice shaft into an enormous pitch-black cavern. Hanging there in utter darkness was a thrill. Kovacs remembers waking in the morning to a woman's voice in song piped through the camp's loudspeaker. It was a popular song at the time, he recalls, but after a while, after weeks and weeks, it got to be too much. He just wanted her to stop. Enough time has passed that now Kovacs can't recollect the song or the singer, just the way her voice drifted through the darkness. I wish I could remember her name, he says. While Kovacs focused on his research, other men serviced the reactor or studied the movements of snow. At the bottom of the base, one team was busy drilling a deep hole into the ice. In 1966, after several years of steady labor, the men punched through the bottom of the glacier to the very surface of Greenland itself. They drilled more than 4,000 feet, gathering in the process the first ice core to ever penetrate an ice sheet. And in almost on a whim, they went further too, collecting 11.5 feet of ancient frozen soil. They only stopped when a drill bearing burned out. That soil would form one of Camp Century's most haunting legacies, though at the time no one thought much about it. For years after the base was abandoned, the soil was stored in jars in a freezer in Buffalo, New York, before being moved to a freezer in Denmark. There was little to suggest that something enlightening might be inside those jars, and few, if any, tools could help unlock their significance. It was only in 2019 that Paul Bierman, a geoscientist and professor at the University of Vermont, and several of his colleagues began to study the contents of the jars. What they found has revolutionized our understanding of Greenland's ancient climate and offered a glimpse of our own possible future. Trapped in the soil, Bierman's team discovered were bits of leaves, twigs, mosses, even insects. The remains could only have come from a time when the region was free of ice, not smothered in a mile-thick glacier. The discovery painted a new picture of Greenland's past. There are things we can learn about ice sheets that we can never learn from the ice itself, says Bierman. It comes from the stuff below the ice. The soil samples provoked a radical departure from earlier vaguer thinking that Greenland's ice cap was a couple of million years old. Working with dozens of other scholars, Biermann showed that the ice cap was younger than anyone had imagined, the soil providing evidence that the land under Camp Century was ice-free about 400,000 years ago. Now, that was during a period in which the landmass had been slightly warmer than it is today and when sea levels were significantly higher. What emerges from the data, he explains, isn't merely an image of the past, but also perhaps a clearer vision of a future in which quadrillions of gallons of fresh water, currently locked up in the Greenland ice cap, melt into the ocean. If that happens, the impacts will be felt nearly everywhere as coastal cities and farms are inundated, potentially turning billions of humans into climate refugees. It's easy to compartmentalize Greenland to say, oh, that's the Arctic. It doesn't matter to me, says Biermann, but the long-forgotten soil from Camp Century draws a straight line to the critical issue of our age. It takes you from 1966 to global climate change and onward to the effects of Greenland's melting. That's pretty profound, he added. Project Iceworm was doomed from the start. What those cold warriors seemed to have miscalculated when they were sketching out their missile tunnels beneath the snow was how much they could prevent glaciers from behaving as if they're alive. They slide and shrink, grow and flow. Building inside the glacier was too unstable and required too much maintenance. Rigid steel railways could buckle under the movement of the ice. Missiles might tip over. The atomic reactor connected to a web of pipes, vents, and conduits that were themselves in motion was at risk as the ice below shifted. Soldiers armed with electric chainsaws roamed the narrow tunnels, working like sculptors, carving back the relentless snow. Army planners eventually had to admit that none of this was a good idea. In 1963, the camp's reactor was shut down, and 3 years later, Century itself was abandoned. When Kovacs returned in 1969 to conduct a survey, he found a total ruin. In a series of photographs he made of the base, one can see something like a mining disaster unfolding in slow motion. Tongues of snow spill down passageways. Steel structures collapse on themselves. Wood beams splinter like bones. The photos give form to the glacier's overwhelming and otherwise invisible weight. Humans had gone only a short time, but already there was the suggestion of an inevitable one-way journey, the debris being crushed and swallowed, never to rise again. All but forgotten for half a century, the camp today delivers a clear-eyed picture of Cold War excess, as well as a dose of nostalgia for a time of grandiose projects. Think of all the energy and resources it took to do this, Biermann says. To build those tunnels and put soldiers down there, it's almost science fiction. No one would dream of doing that today. For all that planning, none of the base's big-thinking architects would ever have imagined that Camp Century's enduring legacy would be the research conducted there, all part of the guise to hide the camp's ulterior nuclear aims. Scientists like Biermann are grateful for that irony, especially when you realize those guys drilling down in that trench back in 1966 had no idea what would happen, he says, no idea how important it would be, and he adds, and they just kept going. Interesting, huh? Well, as many military historians would tell you, past events often remain entrenched and hidden in the very locations where they occurred. Well, no doubt we'll be visiting some times forgotten places in other episodes of Armchair Traveler down the road. Meanwhile, let's stay in the cold zone for our next story. The Long Journey of Canada's Last Reindeer, written by Joshua Hunt, and it has photographs done by Katie Orlinsky. And the article takes us to Canada's Arctic region, where a famous herd with a storied past confronts a new kind of future in the high north. Now, the article is from the March 2025 issue of National Geographic. And we begin. Beneath the snow of the morning sun, thousands of reindeer plod across the frozen far reaches of northwestern Canada. In the slow-moving scrum, the animals' bodies almost disappear under a cloud of vapor as warm breath collides with cold air. A forest of antlers seems to dance in the midst. Glimpsed from afar, the migrating herd looks like one long, sinuous streak of brown painted across the snow-white canvas of an Arctic landscape. In the distance are four inviolate herders in owned snowmobiles, armed with rifles and keeping watch. They are alert, attuned to the rhythm of hooves falling on frozen earth, and on this crisp morning, their job is to escort the reindeer to their calving grounds. But in a grander sense, they're also helping to write a new legacy for this storied herd. They're really smart animals, says Douglas Essigock, whose 7 winters working with the reindeer make him among the most experienced of indigenous herders. I'm always talking to them when I'm moving them. It kind of calms them down when they recognize my voice or the sound of my snow machine. As Canada's last free-ranging reindeer herd drives forward just north of the Arctic Circle, the animals carry with them a link to a legendary experiment. It began about 100 years ago, even after the number of local caribou that the Inuvialuit long depended on began to decline and a bold plan was hatched to address food scarcity by importing reindeer. Caribou and reindeer are the same species, but the latter have been domesticated. Something similar had been tried at the turn of the century in nearby Alaska when waves of reindeer boarded boats and trains to make improbable journeys from Siberia and Norway to North America. In late 1929, a chunk of what was then the burgeoning Alaska reindeer population, some 3,500 reindeer, set off for Canada under the care of Sami and Inuit herders. The arduous, zigzagging 1,500-mile journey ended up lasting more than 5 years, marking a difficult beginning to what came to be known as the Canadian Reindeer Project. Now, decades on, a group of Inuvialuit stakeholders is taking the project further into uncharted territory. The herd, which has been cared for with the help of the Inuvialuit family-owned, was formally purchased in 2021 by the Inuvialuit Regional Corporation. Under the watchful eyes of Essigock and his colleagues, the herd has more than doubled to nearly 6,000 reindeer, making possible an ambitious plan to build a sustainable path to self-reliance for Inuvialuit people living on their ancestral lands. The ultimate goal is to have reindeer abundantly available for the Inuvialuit. That's a goal number one, said Brian Wade, director of the Inuvialuit Community Economic Development Corporation, or organization, I should say. There's the food security component to this herd, but there's also a job creation and the economic component to it, too, he says. The reindeer's transfer to Inuvialuit ownership goes beyond an attempt at establishing stability for the future. It also represents a chance for the Inuvialuit people to take control of a herd imported to their homelands by a colonial government in the 1930s when the reindeer came to the Northwest Territory. The role they were meant to play in the lives of Inuvialuit people was mostly to replace their ancestral food-gathering customs. The Canadian government had been establishing administrative stations and allowing the creation of trading outposts throughout the region following its acquisition of the Northwest Territories in the late 1800s. The indigenous population had for centuries subsisted primarily on hunting, fishing, but with caribou in decline, reindeer were imported to address food shortages. This also changed the relationship the Inuvialuit had with the land, as reindeer would be raised as livestock. Reindeer are classified as domesticated animals, the same as a cow or a chicken or a pig, said Wade. They'll graze all day and just keep moving slowly and slowly and slowly, finding greener pastures. In the years before the IRC took control of the herd, the reindeer were owned by an Inuvialuit family, the Binders, whose association with the reindeer stretched back to their arrival in the Mackenzie Delta. The Binders had grazed the animals and sold reindeer meat, but had increasingly struggled with too few herders to stave off predators and keep the herd from splintering. As the number of reindeer dipped, the Inuvialuit leaders at the IRC were in the process of recognizing the powerful role that a bolstered reindeer population could play in the community. Plenty of Inuvialuit continue to hunt for their food, but it can only be costly and time-intensive effort, and as any hunter will attest, some seasons are better than others. Over recent decades, many families have moved away from the traditional subsistence model, depending instead on food markets and grocery stores stocked by southern food supply chains. In 2020, however, at the outset of the global pandemic, many of those supply chains broke. The IRC, which began to envision a role for the herd in addressing food shortages, could see clearly that the threat was not hypothetical, but immediate. We've been able to really capitalize on the country food that's abundant in our region, but also tie in the reindeer herd so we could alleviate the pressure on the local caribou herd and have the sustainable protein source, said Wade. The purchase of the herd, he added, was part of a two-pronged plan toward food sovereignty. The other initiative was the opening of the country food processing plant in the town of Inuvik, where reindeer, among other food sources, could be prepared and then sent off for distribution to families in need. Before any reindeer could be harvested, though, the herd needed to be nurtured back to full strength. The IRC brought on Essagok and fellow Inuvialet herder Steve Cockney Jr., who then spent months reuniting the dispersed reindeer herd. One of the main challenges was rounding up all the stray animals that were spread out over a huge area, said Essagok. Some groups had strayed as far afield as 80 miles, which meant days of travel for Essagok and his partner. Those smaller groups of reindeer were vulnerable to wolves and other predators, and while many animals had been lost and others roamed beyond the two herders' reach. Essagok said, "We brought all of them together, the ones that we were able to locate anyway." Since then, the IRC has hired four additional herders, with the crew pulling two-week-long shifts of four men on and two men off at any given time. As a result of their efforts, the herd's numbers have swelled up to 6,000, enough for Country Food Processing to start its work with the reindeer. Last spring, the plant, now staffed by five full-time employees, led its first official harvest, preparing 176 reindeer from the herd as roast, ground meat, and ribs, among other items, that were then distributed to Inuvialet community members. The meals provide a crucial source of country food grown and sourced in the region, allowing the Inuvialet households that may not be able to hunt for themselves a chance to stay connected to the land and to this chapter in the Inuvialet story. For Essagok, the opportunity to play such a critical role in this new form of food stability and cultural revitalization has been a crash course in learning by doing. In just 7 years, he, Cockney, and their team became heirs to an indigenous tradition imported from the other side of the Arctic, where the Sami had long mastered the practice. His responsibility to pass his knowledge on to younger herders was made less daunting, he said, by the fact that the region's indigenous hunters already have most of the skills to do the job, given their familiarity with the landscape. "It's not that hard of a job if you grow up hunting," he said. "We try to talk to the younger guys and explain things the best way we can, but a lot of it's hands-on. You learn by doing it and watching and observing the animals. The reindeer teach them too," he said. "Often it feels as if they're the ones leading the way." Wow. Well, also appearing in this March 2025 issue of the National Geographic is a story by Rolf Smith. It's called Reviving Medieval Monsters, and it's accompanied by photographs taken by Tim Jamison. Now, the article explores how modern artisans are honing an age-old style of stonecraft and bringing new beauty to an English cathedral. Let's learn more. On a damp spring morning in the ancient English city of York, a group of schoolchildren stopped in front of the iconic York Minster Cathedral and broke into giggles, sharing uneasy looks. Built over a period of 250 years and consecrated in 1472, the church is the largest Catholic cathedral in Britain. It features three huge medieval towers adorned with shimmering stained glass windows. But the kids were focused more intently on something at the edge of the stonemason's yard outside the building that stared back at them, a large stone statue of a bestial creature in mid-scream, clutching its head as a frog sprang from its mouth. Weighing about half a ton, the freshly made carving is a classic example of a medieval grotesque, a type of ornate architectural decoration that most people see only at a distance. During the Middle Ages, grotesques were placed atop religious buildings alongside similarly fanciful gargoyles, the key difference being that the gargoyles are a style of grotesque with functional rain spouts. Now, this particular monster had been hand-carved of about 1,510 pounds of local limestone by one of York Minster's 12 full-time stonemasons. It is essentially a modern replica. When eventually hoisted up into the buttresses of the cathedral, it will replace a similar statue that had been eroded to a faceless nub by centuries of wind and rain. "We try to replace like for like," says Lewis Morrison, the master stonemason who spent 14 weeks carving the statue. But Morrison admitted that even he wasn't entirely sure that the original creation featured a frog. It was so badly worn you couldn't tell much about it other than the pose with the hand raised beside his head, he says. York Minster stonemasons face a tricky balance in restoring such architectural relics. So in addition to practicing the time-honored techniques of stone carving, they've learned to harness modern technology and take some historically informed artistic license. To recreate the beastly grotesque, for instance, Morrison and his team ascended to the church rooftop where they used a camera capable of taking high-quality images that can be stitched together into a 3D model to render the statue's exact dimensions. Next, they carved the polyurethane model of the weather-worn original as a reference copy, following the same lines, proportions, and silhouette of the original. Morrison then spent weeks researching several similarly posed grotesques on York Minster and poring over the 14th century illustrated manuscripts before coming up with a theme and a design. He eventually chose the timeless theme of good and evil. The beast holds its head when encountering the frog, which is a symbol of demons in medieval folklore. But viewers should also notice that the creature grips a fish in the other hand, symbolizing Christianity. Once the design was approved by the cathedral's architect, the slow, intimate process of carving began. It's one that would have been readily recognizable to Morrison's medieval counterparts with the same tools, same pale limestone, and same musical ring of steel on stone. Cling, 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 sounding across the yard. There's been a permanent stonemason's yard at York Minster for more than 200 years, part of a rolling program of restoration and repairs that began in the late 18th century. It's a never-ending job, says Alex McCallion, director of works and precinct at York Minster. He says our scaffolding is on a 100-year rotation. Today, however, these methods of restoration continue to evolve. The cathedral recently opened a new workspace for its tradespeople called the Center of Excellence for Heritage Skills and Estate Management, an over $10 million state-of-the-art facility just around the corner from the cathedral. The workshop is equipped with computer-controlled stone saws for roughly shaping blocks of limestone, along with laser scanners and digital software to help measure and virtually model designs. These tools can be wielded to not only replicate artifacts, but also create entirely new ones, like the nearly 2-ton statue of the late Queen Elizabeth II, sculpted from a block of French limestone that now stands outside on the west end of the cathedral. It's a big step into the future for us, says McCallion, although we won't be abandoning our roots in traditional craftsmanship. Every piece we make will still be finished by hand using the same tools, mallet, and chisel we've always used. He says it's vital that we do not lose humanity. Very interesting indeed. Well, my friends, that brings us to the end of today's journey on Armchair Traveler. I certainly hope you've enjoyed it and that you'll be with us next time. I'm Mike Edwards, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and I remind you that the content of the program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Armchair Traveler is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. Now, if you have any questions or comments, you may direct them to 919-832-5138. That number again, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.